Welcome to this edition of the Reaction podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. Delighted to say we're joined this week by Liam Halligan, economist extraordinaire, columnist and friend of Reaction, and by Maggie Pagano, executive editor of Reaction. We're going to look at some of the economic news which is around this week. There's a hell of a lot to digest, and we're going to try and make sense of some of that. The question that we're posing, ultimately, though we'll get on to other questions like London, QE, state of the public finances, but the big question is, how tough is it going to get on the economy? And also ask if there are some small grounds for optimism. Liam, what's your assessment on how tough it'll be?
Well, Ian, until quite recently, any of us who had the audacity to talk about the economy were accused of being heartless because it's all about lives or livelihoods, remember? Well, we now know that was completely a false dichotomy, as some of us have been warning for a long time. And I know you have, and Maggie, in your respective writing too. You know, economic nosedives cost lives. The lockdown in and of itself has cost lives, while saving lives, of course. I personally think the lockdown's gone on too long. And I think only now are the mainstream media and political classes really getting their heads around just how serious this economic downturn is. We've just had some growth numbers for May. The economy grew by 1.8% in May compared to the month before. But if the economy falls by 25% over 2 months and then increases by 1.8% the next month, that's not a V-shaped recovery. I mean, that's a sort of crochet needle. We're still well below, well adrift of where growth should be. Obviously, I don't think growth will properly recover back to its previous path for several years. And the real issue we face is one of unemployment. When I was a kid, the UB40 song was 1 in 10. UB40, of course, being the name of the form that the unemployed filled out back in the early 80s. We could easily be, and it gives me no pleasure to say this, 1 in 8, 1 in 7. If you look at the claimant count now, we're already close to 8 or 9% unemployment. And then, of course, we've got getting on for a third of the workforce furloughed, 9.5 million people. With the best will in the world, even with Sunak's job retention scheme giving employers £1,000 for every employee they keep on until January, once the furlough scheme phases out and is ended in October, even with that, there will be many, many businesses who can't afford to keep hold of those furloughed workers, unfortunately. So I think we're heading for unemployment towards the mid-teens as a percentage, worse than anything we've seen in living memory. And that will have major societal, political implications. And I don't really believe that the government or the political class as a whole has yet got its head around what's coming down the track.
Maggie, how tough do you think it's going to be, particularly on that question of jobs and employment? I mean, what do we know so far about the distribution of that unemployment? I mean, one way this might be different this time is that there's also going to be white collar carnage simultaneously, that it's going to be distributed across the economy. In the 80s, you could argue that it was this long tail of a certain form of deindustrialization or a move away from certain kinds of heavy industry, and it was a gradual build up to it. But this is going to be very sudden and very painful for a lot of people, isn't it?
Absolutely, and it's going to affect, in a sense, the most vulnerable and flexible and part-time workers. So retail industry, hospitality, restaurants, tourism, where you have a lot of part-time female workers, a lot of youngsters, that's where they start working. And I think if the prognosis is as we expect it, then we're going to see hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. And then you've got the other big structural changes, so airline industry, which, I mean, it depends how behaviour picks up, doesn't it? But you could see, you know, capacity of about 30% taken out of that industry. And then, it's sort of almost impossible to predict how far. But if you look at London, I know we're going to talk about it later on, but so many offices now can see, so many companies can see that people are working very effectively from home. You had the head of Barclays Bank saying only a few weeks ago, do we ever need an office with 7,000 people in it again? So what's going to happen to the property sector? It's going to be hollowed out at that rate. A lot of the big law firms, insurance firms have said to their staff, we don't oblige you to come back until there's a vaccine. That could be another year away. And it's all the subsidiary industries, isn't it? Companies around, the hairdressers, the dry cleaners, the sandwich shops. You know, if the City of London falls apart, you're going to see most of those businesses closing.
Yeah, there's a potential difficulty there. I think in terms of let's take London, take somewhere like the area around Fleet Street or another part of the city, all of that ancillary supporting economy goes, whether that be, as you said, Maggie, dry cleaners or coffee shops. Those people are probably coming in. People working in those stores are probably coming in from somewhere like Croydon or another part of London. Now, they're in the part of the economy where it's going to be relatively easy. They may have to delay their bigger ambitions in life, but it's going to be relatively straightforward for them to switch and to look for whatever work is going, whether it be in an Amazon warehouse. It might not be the work they absolutely want, but they can retool fairly quickly. The white collar thing fascinates me because I just, knowing finance directors, don't want to be too down on finance directors as a class, but knowing how they think, there will be at the moment calculations being done about businesses who've core functions, whether it be HR, marketing, administration, IT, that they've experienced during the lockdown, that they've managed to function, their revenues have fallen, but they've managed to function pretty effectively with perhaps only a quarter of the staff. That is about to play out in the economy, isn't it, Liam? Is that those businesses are almost going to use this crisis as a cover to restructure. And that's going to leave a lot of people clambering onto LinkedIn to look for jobs, which unfortunately are probably not going to be there. Do you think, am I being unnecessarily gloomy?
No, I think you put your finger on it in your earlier comments, Ian. This is going to be different from the early 80s when it was largely about blue-collar workers being restructured, being deindustrialized, as you say. A ghastly phrase, but it was in vogue then, wasn't it? This time around, it's going to be very different, and you will get a lot of middle managers getting hammered. There'll be an awful lot of depression among, men and women aged sort of 35 to 55 who thought they were entering the peak earning period of their lives, and their jobs, if they're not abolished completely, could easily be offshored. So they're much cheaper for companies as companies strive to survive. I mean, given the unemployment coming down the track, Sunak had to do something in his mini budget. And so he came up with the various job creation schemes. Now, we'll remember from the 80s and the 90s that a lot of those schemes, they're well meant, but they don't have a great track record. Youth opportunity schemes, YTS, Workstart, and all the rest of it, they suffer from dead weight loss. A lot of the time, the state will be subsidizing jobs that may have existed anyway. They suffer from displacement effects, substitution effects, where younger workers are favoured over slightly older workers, and big firms who can afford to take people on can then take people on more cheaply than small firms who can't. So their advantages are amplified. He had to do something, but if you look at the experience of the 80s and 90s with these job creation schemes, they're not very good value for taxpayers, and they won't actually create that many jobs. I think we're going to have a situation where young people, it's a very, very worrying time for them, of course, but they could actually do quite well because they've got these job creation schemes promoting them and they're cheaper than older people with families. So firms could ask younger people to act up, if you like, in the same way, say, that women stepped into the breach during the First and Second World War, and that changed, you know, social patterns of work. But that will leave a generation of middle-aged people in a really, really difficult situation. And a lot of these people will have big mortgages. A lot of these people will be coming into the period of their life where their outgoings are huge. And so there's going to be a lot of retrenchment. There's going to be a lot of books being written about people being a lot worse off than their parents. And they'll be talking about people in their 30s, 40s, and their 50s. And so there will be a lot of talk also about how capitalism isn't working for ordinary people. There was a sense that that agenda was coming through over the last couple of years. But I think it's really going to come to the fore now. And then, of course, there's the regional element, because, as you said in your comments, Ian, there is more work in London. There is more work in Manchester and in the Midlands. But the Tories' levelling up agenda has never been more essential than it is now. Post-Brexit, this was always going to be a sort of period of big policy upheaval. If you combine Brexit with the 2019 election result, where the Tories want to keep the Red Wall seats and they want to have a proper regional policy, which they can do post-Brexit, of course, because the competences return from Brussels. This is always going to be a huge sort of policy-making period, more so than any time since the 80s. But if you put COVID on top of that and the necessity to respond to the economic hammer blow that is COVID, the incredible stresses and strains put on our public finances that is COVID, we're going to be in a kind of New Jerusalem situation. This is going to be not a sort of 80s situation. This is going to be a post-1945 situation where all policy making is up for grabs. We don't know which way it's going to go, but when you're going to have, you know, respectable, professional, middle-class people in their 40s and 50s, not in their 20s, saying, capitalism isn't working for me. It's not working for my family. You know, my kids are emigrating to Australia and New Zealand. What's going on? We are going to have an absolutely huge policy upheaval in the next few years. And it strikes me that it's going to be very, very difficult for our political system to handle that kind of debate when, you know, in the age of sort of wokery and political correctness, we're not even allowed to discomfort people in what we say. So how are you going to have, like, the mother of all policy debates about how we, you know, shore up our society, shore up our economy, shore up capitalism itself, shore up, frankly, the kind of geopolitical standing of the Western world, when we're not allowed to say anything that might make you feel uncomfortable?
Yeah. Yeah. Maggie, Liam talked there very eloquently about the policy shakeup there's going to be. I mean, let's take it as read that we all broadly agree that the Chancellor had to do roughly what he did in terms of the big measures and the big spending and just blowing the deficit. It's an emergency war style event. But beyond that, are you confident that Sunak and Number 10 have done enough? Is there enough in there in terms of retooling the economy, encouraging people to start businesses, or are you disappointed?
Deeply disappointed. And it's something that, you know, we've been trying to bang the drum on for the last few weeks, months. I agree with Liam. Sunak had to do something to protect what he has. We don't know what will happen to those other jobs. But so far, he hasn't used any of the levers which I think are available to create jobs. And we all know that jobs come from small companies, one-man bands, businesses like our own. And there's absolutely no incentive there. And yet there are billions and billions of pounds sitting in private individuals' hands, the angels. They don't want to invest in the stock market right now. And so he should be creating greater incentives to bring that money into small businesses. Many of them are overcapitalized, huge debt, and what they actually need is equity, not loans. So the first thing he should do is increase the threshold on EIS and SEIS, I think in the north, going back to the levelling up, you've got to create, you know, really huge enterprise zones, just take out all taxes and bring business back. And there will be new businesses. We've talked about all those that will restructure and have to close down. But, you know, we might see onshoring coming back, whether it's PPE equipment, for example. We're going to have to start manufacturing that here in the UK. And there are other examples of that. So there are, and the whole life sciences, vaccines, treatments. So there are opportunities for growth. But it doesn't strike me that anybody at Number 10 or the Treasury are quite woken up to that. And we know they're huge campaigns. It's not like they're not aware of it, because many in the city are lobbying them sort of day in, day out.
The other thing I'm surprised about, Maggie, is that, and it, maybe this is explained just by the fact that they run a very closed network system in Number 10, and you know they like hearing their own ideas reflected back at them, and it's not a particularly economics minded or markets orientated Number 10 operation. But I'm surprised that they haven't yet worked out that they're going to need, about now really, but running from now and into the autumn and next year, campaigns to encourage people to start their own businesses, because we know that one of the major costs of unemployment kicks in when it becomes long-term unemployment. So those finance directors I described earlier are making those decisions now, or made them a couple of weeks ago. There's the 40-something day consultation process to go through for restructuring large companies. So it's likely you'll see, and this is what the OBR projections point to, that the surge really kicking in once furlough ends in September, October, November. So it is possible for people to, even with a small amount of capital, to start something, even if it's to set themselves up in a consultancy or to turn themselves into a company or band together with some colleagues with a good idea. We're going to need that wonderful capitalist process to happen hundreds of thousands of times. I'm astonished that the government isn't already running a campaign on this. Maybe they're just waiting, Liam, until it happens, or waiting to see how bad it is, or is it a reflection of what I described earlier, that they're not particularly economically minded?
Maggie?
Yeah, no, we're going to say the same thing. I think there's groupthink in Treasury. None of them have run small businesses. Sunak, you know, was a banker. He wasn't. He was a hedge fund manager. You know, they don't understand small businesses. And I think they just sort of get into a mindset, and they're just looking at increasing taxes rather than actually creating an environment of enterprise. And I don't know how you change that. Over to you, Liam.
It strikes me that at the we're in a situation where only like the British public are going to solve this, and this. The grounds for optimism that I have, and I am an optimist by in terms of my personality, you know, we have a tremendously entrepreneurial workforce. We have real commercial acumen in this country. We've proved it again and again and again over the years and generations. It's not a fluke that this tiny island is still the fifth or sixth biggest economy in the world. And I agree with Maggie. We should be harnessing that entrepreneurial ability rather than stifling it. And what's happening at the moment is that the government is heading towards making another big mistake. If they extend the furlough scheme, they will either end up bankrupting the country, or they pretend they're not bankrupting the country by ordering basically the Bank of England to keep buying yet more government bonds. And this brings us to quantitative easing. Now, quantitative easing has been expanded by £300 billion in the last 4 months. So it started out as a £50 billion necessary emergency measure after the financial crisis. It then, over 10 odd years, morphed into a sort of lifestyle choice. It became addictive because it pumps up stock prices, it pumps up bond prices, it makes it cheap for governments who want to keep spending to borrow. But we've massively expanded QE as a result of COVID. And what QE does, it makes it almost impossible for financial markets to correct, which is very, very dangerous because you blow bubbles, as we have in the share stock market and also in the bond market, with bond prices going to the moon and yields coming down. And that's why we have a situation where, you know, the S&P 500 is now above where it was in November pre-COVID, even though the US economy is contracting by 8, 9, 10% and corporate balance sheets are drowning in red ink. FTSE 100 is in bull market territory, despite the deepest economic contraction in 300 years. In terms of financial investment, complete disconnect between asset prices and economic reality on the ground. But then you have, you know, most other investors, real world investors, strategic investors, people that own businesses and are thinking about whether or not to remortgage their house, to reinvest or plow their life savings in. Investors who take strategic stakes and sit on boards. People that don't invest through a computer screen via a broker, but who invest with their own money, with their sleeves rolled up, you know, from the back of their car, if you know what I mean. And those kind of investors, the investors who actually generate wealth rather than buy and sell and broker, they are, while their financial equivalent are gorging on QE and it's leading to huge exuberance in financial markets, real world investors are completely spooked by this stuff. They basically think that between them, the political class and the media class and, you know, their mates in the city are about to cause another crash.
Yeah.
And so there is so much, and Maggie's written about this a lot, and Reaction deserves a lot of praise for keep highlighting this family company, small SME sector, which is where most of our innovation happens, where most of our people are employed, two-thirds of them, where most of our growth happens. That wealth generating heartland of the UK is completely stymied because it doesn't want to invest because it thinks there's going to be a sort of systemic collapse because the central banking excess does not make any sense to them. And I completely share their disconsternation with it. And that's where we are. If you talk to the most sophisticated political analysts in this country, and we know many of them between us, they're just like, oh, yeah, debt service costs are low. It's fine, old boy. It'll be different this time. No. If it was, that's the four, five most dangerous words in the English language. It's different this time.
Yeah, which is it's doubly ironic this time, Liam, when we consider that how different the world looks in early January. So we've moved from one consensus, you know, really rapidly through this crisis. You know, back in January, if you'd said the deficit's going to be in excess of 300 billion, you'd have said, well, obviously not. Only a nuclear war is going to produce some shock like that.
Yeah.
And all the assumptions of January have been ditched and been replaced with a new consensus, as you describe, which is that just money will be cheap forever because we say that it'll be cheap forever. And I understand the academic argument about why inflation immediately doesn't seem likely. But over the course of the next 10, 20 years, we've just been taught this really extraordinary lesson between late January and now about the power of events and how we're not as sophisticated as we think we are, but we've moved on to the comfort of just the idea that money will be cheap forever. Do you think, though, Liam, that the Brits are just going to stick with, in terms of the policymakers, Bank of England, Treasury, do you see any sign that they're going to change course on this, or that Bailey wants to do something slightly different, or that the party will be over at some point later in the year, or is it just this is the policy response and that's it?
Look, no one's saying it's easy. I'm not here to throw rocks at people who are are doing their best. But it does seem to me that we should be trying to calm financial markets rather than send them even further into hyperspace and away from reality. There was a period under Janet Yellen, actually, who I think was the best central banker since Paul Volcker, where the US was trying to lead the Western world back towards positive, not just nominal, but real terms, interest rates, when she implemented her rate rises and basically told financial markets to lump it, and they did lump it. It was fine. But then Trump appointed Jerome Powell and, you know, kept calling him a moron on Twitter. And Jerome Powell then reversed a lot of what Janet Yellen had done. And now, obviously, the Fed is buying up not just government debt, but corporate bonds. The Bank of England's heading that way too, making very, very political decisions about what companies to bail out. The Bank of England's clearly, if you follow the rhetoric closely, gearing up to yank us into a period of negative nominal interest rates, not just negative real interest rates. They've been negative in real terms, of course, after inflation for a long time, but negative nominal interest rates, even though that will weaken the banking sector, even though that will send us even further down the economic rabbit hole. It's you know, everybody's scared to challenge the way this is going because they're scared of causing a systemic implosion. But we do have to grasp the nettle here, because we're clearly moving further and further away from a sustainable situation. So it's not about the politics of, you know, whether Andrew Bailey likes Rishi Sunak. You know, it's about what the markets think. And we have to understand, it's so obvious to say it, but it's so often misunderstood, that the interest rate is not what the Bank of England says it is. The interest rate is what the market determines it to be, whatever the Bank of England says and does. And for now, of course, investors look at the politics and they think the Bank of England will keep buying those gilts. So that's fine. The gilts will stay, the yields will stay roughly where they are, and the political class will think it's all okay. But that can't go on forever. You know, a fifth of all bonds in the world now have a negative yield. This is seriously stymieing growth. You are starting to see some of the, you know, big names of central banking raising the alarm bells, even here in the UK. Mervyn King has been raising the alarm about an excessive use of QE. Even Charles Goodhart has been raising the alarm bell, another former very senior member of staff at the Bank of England. Paul Tucker as well, the guy who would have been the central banker here had it not been Andrew Bailey. You know, Sunak, we have, despite his youth, possibly the most financially sophisticated chancellor of our lifetimes, with the possible exception of Nigel Lawson. But this is a bloke who has got a feel for financial markets and has got a lot of credibility. Yep. And he should be using his credibility now to start a dialogue with financial markets to say, look, we don't want to go down this rabbit hole. We want to try and keep some kind of policy normality here, because what we're doing is deeply counterproductive. And it is deeply counterproductive. QE is keeping alive a lot of zombie companies that can just about service their debts at these interest levels but can't grow. QE is building up an even bigger financial bubble that, when it bursts, will cause a lot of pain and do serious damage to the brand of capitalism. It will do serious damage to the public's faith in the idea of free markets, which will have huge political knock-on effects coming, you know, just a decade after what was previously the biggest collapse in our history. So these are very, very big issues. And at the moment, we're barely even talking about them. You know, the idea that QE is a problem is literally a sidebar in the business sections at the moment. And it should be front and center of our politics.
Yeah. No, Liam, I was going to ask you two things, really. One is, I totally agree with you on QE. Can it be, if you like, unrolled? How do you unroll it? One. And two, you said Sunak should be using his credibility. How would you like to see him do that? Do we start reversing interest rates? Do you have to very gradually turn it? I mean, what if you were in Threadneedle Street, what would you be advising?
Again, it's very, very tough. It's easy for me sitting at my desk at home talking into a mic to sound as if I've got all the answers. I haven't got all the answers, but I do know that you have to signal that things are going to change. It starts with fiscal probity. It starts with laying out a route map for how we can return to some kind of budgetary stability and normality, where we're not entirely dependent, as we currently are, given that the tax base has been so badly depleted by COVID, on our own central bank buying gilts. We have to admit that this is what we're doing. I say this stuff and I'm treated like some kind of conspiracy theorist.
But it's true. Do you think, Liam, is there another way to think about it? And James Spruill, the economist, wrote about this the other day, that one potential answer might be to ring fence that COVID debt. I think he referred to the idea of issuing Sunak securities with a 50-year life. David Davis, on the Tory former cabinet minister, has talked about something similar, that you can then say to the markets, look, we're not just spending as a country with no end in sight. This is a block of 250, 300 billion, which is the payment for the crisis. And it's however you then decide to issue the debt and however you structure it. The Brits and the city are good at inventing these things, as we know throughout history. But you at least then draw a line under it. Is that one potential approach?
I think that's right. I think James Spruill is a very interesting guy, and he's got some good ideas. Look, we have a lot of wealth in this country. We have huge institutional funds in pensions, in insurance companies that want to invest. We have the fund management capital of the world and a lot of very smart, innovative people, as you say, Ian. You know, it may be that there's a case for some kind of debt jubilee on some of the COVID-related loans that have gone out to companies. That's something that we should be looking at closely. And it may be, as David Davis has said, that we kind of ring fence a lot of this COVID era debt and restructure it so it can provide some kind of low but steady and legally guaranteed return for investors who face the alternative of getting a definite negative yield on their gilts that they're often forced by regulatory diktat to invest their clients' funds into. And of course, their clients are often ordinary households with, you know, a tiny little pension or a life assurance policy. What we can't do, Ian, which is what we're currently doing at the moment, is that pretend that this isn't a problem. We're better than that. Okay, our political discourse should be better than that. Commentators like me, you, and Maggie, with like some inkling of economic and financial nous, unlike most of the political commentators, need to speak out and say, we need to sort this. There are ways to sort it. And, you know, we have people in this country who will be better at sorting it than almost anyone in the world. But we can't pretend that we're some kind of proto reserve currency like America, and we can just keep printing hard currency, because sterling in that sense is a very respected currency. We're a very respected economy. We do contract law better than anyone else in the world. You know, our people, for the most part, overwhelmingly pay their taxes. We have a lot of innovation. We will grow in the future. We are a good bet. We are a good place to do business. But before we just sleepwalk our way into some kind of systemic collapse that will massively undermine the case for free markets, for liberty, for capitalism, for business, we need to admit that this is happening and put a ring around this problem and tell ourselves and the world how we are going to finance this. And there hasn't been one inkling of that from Downing Street since it became clear that we are going to have a budget deficit this year approaching 20% of GDP. Now, that is an irresponsible position for us
now,
to be.
Now, Maggie, Liam mentioned a few minutes ago Rishi Sunak. I think it's a really good comparison with Nigel Lawson. I mean, as I hear it, he is, and the Treasury official view is that he's has a voracious appetite for work. He's good to deal with. He hoovers up.
We're lucky to have him. We're lucky to have him, right?
Isn't it going to be the case, Maggie, that the test of him is just about to begin now? The doling out the money was, I know it wasn't easy, but it was that it is easier than what's to come. And I see it almost as this fascinating test of personality and character, because having got the job with an agreement that to merge his advisor team with number 10, and to some people feared he would be the creature of number 10 and Dominic Cummings, to emphasize to the markets that there is a plan, to create a plan, he's going to have to, it's not a case of striking out on his own, but he's going to have to grow and become a Lawson-like figure, someone capable of driving the agenda, sometimes disagreeing with the Prime Minister. Sort of the nice, you know, we talk every day, Boris and Rishi show, and the era of the furlough is coming to an end. Something tougher is going to be required. And also, he's going to be in the middle of all of this. I mean, he's risen very, very fast, maybe too fast too soon. Is that he's then quite a convenient person to blame for 4 million unemployed, if, God forbid, if it gets to that. So he's in the most fascinating position politically. Do you rate him, Maggie?
Yes, I do. And I did from that very first, was it the Thursday or the Friday night, when he first started the rescue package. And he said, and he sort of looked straight into the camera, straight into the public's eye, "We'll be judged by our compassion." And I sort of felt slight sort of shiver, because you don't usually associate compassion with conservatism, although Maurice Sarchi always said that that was the ideal combination. Anyway, but moving on, and I think he does love the job. He supposedly sits up until midnight reading all the screens, really enjoys it. Let's park for a moment the small business bit. But I think that he will not want to be blamed for 4 million unemployed. And I suspect he will be brave enough to stand up to Boris, who clearly does not have a feel for a political economy. He doesn't have an economic viewpoint. So whether it's Cummings or who else that he has to persuade, but I think he will be brave. And Lawson is the right. He's got to be as bold and courageous as Lawson was with tax cuts. I mean, to tax cut in this sort of environment would be sort of counterintuitive, but it is probably what is needed to release some of this wealth. And I'm also an optimist. I would hope he grows into it and he takes it on. And he'll have to work closely with Bailey, I would have thought. But Bailey will be the person behind him, and Andy Haldane, figures like that, who could persuade the political class that what he's doing is right.
Well, you've seen the
seen
the reports this week that they're looking for a clean out at the Treasury, and I think Tom Scholar is reported to be in the firing line, and I've certainly heard that myself. I think that would be absolute madness. Exactly. I think Britain finds itself in a highly unusual situation, in that at the bank that it has, if you're lucky enough going into this extraordinary storm on debt and debt management that's coming, it's not just coming to Britain, it's coming to all the major Western economies. If you're lucky enough to have Bailey at the bank with John Cunliffe, veteran of the Treasury in the 2008 crisis, and then at the Treasury you've got Tom Scholar, veteran of the 2008 crisis, institutional memory and experience and just calmness during a crisis really matters. And it would be absolute madness to see this in terms of a purge in the way that number 10 is seeing other parts of the civil service. So, well, let's see. Listen, we're just going to wrap up with a final question to both of you. You've both mentioned at various points the O word, optimism. Just start with you, Maggie. What, with all this terrible economic news, and it is going to be really tough, but what makes you optimistic about Britain's economic future?
It is exactly, again, as Liam said, it is that the British spirit is entrepreneurial. It is innovative. We've got world-class businesses and manufacturing, high-value manufacturing, in life sciences, in biotech, in the creative arts. Let's not forget the arts, which are going to be hammered. We have so much brain power. And really, we just need a government, actually, that recognises this and could sort of unleash, I hate to use Keynes's animal spirits, but you know, we've done 4 months of lockdown. It's going to take a while to come out of it. And I think fear is the great factor. And we've got to get rid of the fear of people resuming their lives. Once they do, then I think we can bounce back. There'll be long-term scarring, yes. But yeah, I have my trust in people's optimistic human nature. They'll be out there starting new businesses. They already are.
Liam, an optimistic.
Well, I should say that I do rate Sunak and I do wish him well. I think we're lucky to have him in that role. You know, he doesn't need to do this and he clearly wants to serve. And that's a tremendous sort of psychological base for him to build on. He needs to demonstrate leadership. I agree that the we do need a shake-up in the civil service, but you want to clean the stables out. You don't want to burn them down. So he will have to show some real intellectual leadership. I think Boris will go with him if Boris feels that Sunak's got it under control. You know, he needs to give a series of speeches, you know, along the lines of Lawson's, you know, seminal 1984 Mays lecture, and basically he completely flipped round macro and microeconomics, and that's when we really began to bear down on inflation in this country, which led to, you know, far greater levels of investment and economic growth and a lot of the good things that eventually came out of the turmoil of the 1980s. I don't see any signs that he's doing that at the moment. I don't see anyone around him who could help him to do that, frankly. I am optimistic because we're in the UK and I think the rest of the world respects what we do, knows that we're good at what we do. We can't be complacent, though, Ian. As I said, Sterling's reserve currency status has long gone. We have a huge trade deficit. There will be a lot of currency traders who want to focus on sterling as the weeks and months go by and the ugly contest begins in earnest, the ugly contest being how markets assess various major currencies of the world and which one is in the weakest position. And of course, the currency markets will be egged on by our overwhelmingly, massively negative media class, who will almost relish in the government's financial difficulties. And I say that as a seasoned hack and no one's patsy, as I hope both of you will agree. But it is quite astonishing the relentless negativity that much of our media heaps on a government which has made huge mistakes and is full of, you know, ego and childish behaviour, as all governments are. But it's a very, very difficult thing that they're trying to do. So we will have a huge amount of negativity going forward from our media class, many of them, of course, with their nice state-financed sinecures. But I think out there in the highways and byways of corporate Britain, there will be lots and lots of people doing their best, trying to build businesses, trying to keep people on, trying to keep people employed. The danger is if the government sleepwalks into a systemic crisis. That's why it's absolutely vital, this idea of debt management and how we're going to restructure our debts in order to make them sustainable has to be front and centre of the political debate. We all need to get a lot more au fait and across these conceptual financial issues. And the government has to avoid making things worse by reaching for heavy regulation, heavy taxation, and putting us in a position where we're trying to recover from this deep government-induced recession with one hand behind our backs. So I think Sunak's role is to provide sophisticated financial and economic leadership, and it's Boris's role to let Sunak get on with it, to back him to the hilt, and to do what Boris is good at, which is basically banging the drum and spreading some
optimism. And on that optimistic note, thank you to Liam Halligan for joining us, and thank you to Maggie Pagano. If you're not a Reaction subscriber, go to the site and become a Reaction subscriber. Until the next edition of the Reaction podcast, thank you very much for listening.
Can I just say before we go, Ian, my Telegraph Planet Normal podcast, which I co-present with Alison Pearson, this week we've got a fabulous interview with Luke Johnson, the entrepreneur, the retailer, somebody who was pivotal to recreating the British high street in the 80s and 90s. Of course, the man behind the tremendous success of Pizza Express. And so I'd urge your listeners to give it a try.